Okay, I'm going to open the House Committee on Land Use. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3096. And Representative Wisnett, would you like to bring your folks with it? Other people will be arriving, I'm sure, but there's another committee I'm interested in as well that's going on, like most people, so we're not going to wait for other people.
Don't want it too close.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and honorable colleagues.
Uh-huh. Let's talk about you, Lynn.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for hearing House Bill 3096 this afternoon in the committee. I think it's a simple, easy bill that I hope the committee will have a work session soon and pass it out. I was approached on the bill by the River Meadows Homeowners Association. This is different, Mr. Chair, than our land use and destination resort mm-hmm. bills. This is a entirely different bill that in situation with sewer and water.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're asking to do is amend ORS Chapter 554 relating to nonprofit water improvement companies to allow such companies to own and operate sanitary sewer systems and existing developments where domestic water is already supplied by the ORS Chapter 554 Corporation. You're going to hear from a member of that community about to describe the community for you and why they want this. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. White, the attorney for River Meadows Improvement, and I'll be staying with you to answer questions about this bill.
Great. Okay. Thank you.
Members of the committee, my name is Bruce White. I'm a land use attorney in Bend. And I have with me today Ray Yillick, who's the Vice President of the Homeowners Association for River Meadows. He's also the Vice President of the River Meadows Sanitary Sewer Corporation and also the River Meadows Improvement District. And the entity that we're really kind of going to be focusing on today is the River Meadows Improvement District, which is organized under ORS Chapter 554. That's the entity that this legislation concerns. We're trying to expand the powers of that or authority of that entity to not only supply domestic water but also to supply sanitary sewer. Those facilities already exist. River Meadows has been in existence since the 1970s. It actually predates the land use planning system. The first plat was platted in 1973. The district itself dates from 1976. So we're not trying to do an end run around Oregon's land use system. We're simply trying to deal with a community that would like to consolidate some of its services into one entity. And I'm going to have Ray Yillick here just talk to you a little bit about more about the nature of this community. We also have with us today the general manager of the district, Dave Wayland, and also Terry Burke, excuse me, she's on the board. And one, I would just point out that Ms. Burke is from Portland. She doesn't live in River Meadows, but she has a second home there. And one of the issues that, as we talk about why we'd like to expand the powers of this entity rather than form a wholly new special district, is that we want to keep our owners who are non-residents, we don't want to disenfranchise them from being able to vote for board members, and also we want them to be able to stand as board members, and that wouldn't be available to us if we were to form a special district under existing law. Mm. So with that, I'll turn it back to I'll talk a little bit after Mr. Yillick just about what we think the bill does.
Well, thank you for allowing us this time. My name is Ray Yellick. I'm currently the Vice President of River Meadows Homeowners Association and the two other corporations that run our utilities. River Meadows is a 239-lot residential planned community covering 160 acres along the Deschutes River. It's south of Sun River and north of La Pine. I think you've been provided with a map showing showing the location of the property and the layout of the development. The development is completely built out except for 39 lots, and is made up of an almost even split between full-time residents and owners who use their property as second homes. The development was initiated in the early 70s under the name Stage Stop Meadows, with the first lots platted in October 1973. From the beginning, the development was planned with community water and sewer services. Water is provided by the River Meadows Improvement District, which was established in 1976 under state law as an Oregon Chapter 555 Water Improvement District. The sewer is provided by a separate private nonprofit corporation known as River Meadows Sanitary Sewer Corporation, established when the developer finally turned over the sewer system to the homeowners in 2000. These sewer and water services are provided only to River Meadows Development and not to any property outside of the community. The sewer system consists of a collection system and three-cell treatment lagoon with land application. The system is permitted by the Department of Environmental Quality. The development had a somewhat protracted history that predates most of the current resident. The original developer died, and for years development activities were run through the developer's estate. The development was replatted in the late 1980s to make for a more attractive and workable development pattern. During this time, there were significant issues between the owners and the developer in the development of the sewer system that resulted in litigation between the owners and the developer. These issues were finally resolved in the early 2000s, and our community has owned and operated the sewer system since that time. River Meadows also has a homeowners association organized under state law that manages and maintains the common areas of the development, such as the development's private roads, its clubhouse, and other common areas and facilities. This means that River Meadows has three separate corporate entities involved in providing services to the property owners there. Having three different corporate entities can be a little bit confusing and leads to inefficiencies in governance, ownership, and operations of our community. The proposed bill would allow us to consolidate ownership and operation of at least the River Meadows water and sewer system into a single entity, rather than having each system privately owned and subject to separate government requirements. We are aware that there are other private and public corporate alternatives for consolidating ownership and operation of the River Meadows water and sewer systems, and our attorney will go into greater detail on why we would like to have ownership and operation consolidated in River Meadows Improvement District under the Oregon Chapter 554. Our interest in consolidating ownership and operation is guided by the following considerations. One, to bring both water and sewer facilities under single ownership to achieve the efficiencies and greater clarity in governance, ownership and operation of the River Meadows water systems. Two, to provide for tax-exempt status for both water and sewer systems and the entity that owns each. Currently, the River Meadows community, the water system, is tax-exempt under ORS Chapter 554, while the sewer system is not. And three, to not burden our community with the governance requirements often associated with municipal entities. And four, to allow our non-resident members, such as Board Member Terry Burke, who is attending from Portland today, the opportunity to vote in elections and to serve on our board of directors. The latter point is particularly important in a community such as ours that is made up of so many non-resident members. Our community is very supportive of making our governance and operation of River Meadows water and sewer facilities more efficient and to gain the advantages of operating the sewer system through a nonprofit tax-exempt entity such as the River Meadows Improvement District. As I mentioned, about half of our owners are non-resident owners, and many of them have their permanent residence here in the Willamette Valley. We have reviewed our ownership address list and find that we have owners in all districts of all the members of the House Land Use Committee, except for Chair Klim. We expect that some of these non-residents may contact you directly to note their support for this bill. Bruce will provide additional technical information regarding the bill, and we thank you for this opportunity to testify.
Well,
I've provided you written testimony that goes into some of our thinking on why we came down to deciding that our best option really was to not go for a special district, but to try to expand the existing authority of the existing district that we have. And that's actually on the second page of my testimony, or actually at the bottom of the first page and going over to the second page. Basically, there's about three or four reasons. Some of them have already been mentioned by President Jelic. But primarily, well, one of the primary reasons, first of all, we want to be able to consolidate our operations. We know we can't consolidate completely because our homeowners association still needs to have its status under the Oregon Planned Community Act to be able to monitor and maintain the common areas. But as it relates to the utilities, we thought we could at least combine those two functions in one entity. We don't want to disenfranchise our non-resident owners, which is what we'd have to do if we went under the authority of an existing or the existing authority of a special district, a joint sewer and water sewer and water district, which is allowed under ORS Chapter 450-600. So we chose a course to try to amend the statutes for improvement districts because, A, that would consolidate our management. It would allow for our non-resident owners still to have a voice in the community as it relates to the provision of utilities. And it would provide a seamless transfer without having, it would be a transfer of assets without having to form a new entity. Also important is the fact that the sewer facilities would then gain tax-exempt status, which is important to our members as well. I also explained kind of section by section in the second page of my letter what the bill does. It's really quite simple. It's the first three sections, really, that address River Meadows concerns. The first section amends the corporate purposes to expand them in the manner that we've talked about. The second amends the powers of an improvement district, again, to include the matters that we're talking about. And then the third section just talks about how this is implemented, that we don't need I think the legislation contemplates you're going to build a system from the ground up. In this case, we're taking over an existing system. So Section 3 just deals with some practicalities related to taking over an existing system. There are other sections in the bill that we didn't draft, but I think Legislative Council took the opportunity to modernize the statute. I think these things may be about as old as some irrigation districts, so the statutes seem to be somewhat dated. But those housekeeping parts of the bill aren't really essential to our purpose. And like I said, we're not trying to do an end around the land use system. There may be some concern among some folks with sewers outside of urban growth boundaries, but these sewers have been in place or authorized since before Senate Bill 100. And we have continually, since 1974, had permitting or permits in place from DEQ. We have a land use compatibility statement signed off on by the county that we're in compliance with land use laws. So anyways, with that, I think it's relatively simple, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay. Questions from committee members? Representative Patrick.
I'm sorry, I missed the very beginning of your testimony, but just in a nutshell, nothing is really changing other than just how you're managing what is already there.
That's right. We're just trying to consolidate the governance or one entity. So.
And on the sewer, the company that owns the sewer entity now, are they organized under this same 55? 4020 or no?
No, because the statute presently doesn't authorize those companies to own and operate sewer facilities. So it is a private nonprofit corporation created under the Oregon's nonprofit corporation laws, but it doesn't have any special status, and that's one reason we would want to collapse that into the ORS 554 corporation, because there is statutory authority that's more closely aligned to providing utility-type services to landowners.
Okay. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair. Could you estimate what sort of savings administratively, operationally, you would expect from doing this?
Well, I mean, there's two ways we're going to save. Yeah. One is because we don't have to do three sets of books anymore. We only have to do two. There will be a cost saving to our patrons from the fact that the sewer facilities will then become tax exempt from real property taxation. That's about a $6,000 bill every year. So there's two different aspects. The third aspect is, I don't know whether you can quantify it. I don't think you can, but it's the idea that we don't have to be concerned anymore about which hat we're wearing when we're doing which activity. Are we wearing the improvement district hat, or are we wearing the private nonprofit sewer corporation hat? I don't know that I can give you a specific answer.
Yeah, thank you.
Follow up.
Yeah, and I just comment as a attorney who does some business and nonprofit work myself. A nonprofit corporation does seem like an odd entity to own and operate a facility like this.
So yes.
I'm glad you brought this to our attention. Yes. You've been creative in how you've dealt with it until now.
Yeah, and I think we'd like to be less creative
yeah.
and maybe more mainstream.
Vice Chair Cameron. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there any other examples in the state, your situation currently?
Not that I'm aware of. I don't, these improvement districts, at least I was in the county council's office in Deschutes County for 11 years, and I don't recall running across another improvement district, at least in Deschutes County. So I can't answer your question as to how prevalent this issue might be.
And the solution you've got here only authorizes someone to take ownership of and operate an existing sanitary
Correct.
Facility, and only if they were already furnishing land with water, so it'd have to be already doing it,
right.
an existing facility, already doing the water, and then they're taking over an existing sanitary facility
right.
as well.
We consciously wanted to keep this as narrow in its application as possible.
At least you didn't put the name River Meadows in the bill. Sometimes that happens,
yes.
too.
Chair, as you and I know, we didn't mention the organization in case there is someone out there we don't know about.
Right, so yeah. That's wise. Wise. We've been through it.
Tar Heels or the Beavers?
We don't want to.
Mr. Yes, Representative.
Just one quick question. I heard you say that it would save about $6,000 a year in property taxes to somebody, which means to somebody out there, they're going to think that means we're going to be getting $6,000 less per year. How do your local governments feel about this?
Well, I guess one way or another, because our other option, of course, is to do the special district, which would have the same result from a tax standpoint. It's just we would end up disenfranchising some of our members. So I guess in the end, it's probably not going to make any difference. And secondly, of course, the $6,000 is spread over all of the taxing districts. So schools, county, vector control, fire. So I guess it's not going to be a huge hit to any particular taxing district.
Yeah, Representative Holby.
Thanks. I'm trying to understand if you were to create a special district, how is that going to disenfranchise your members?
Well, under special districts, their elections are run by the county clerk. And in
registered.
Order to
be registered to vote,
you have to be registered to vote at the site.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And so it would mean not only could they not vote, but they couldn't serve on our board either.
Mm-hmm.
if they were from somewhere else.
Right.
Yeah. And the other thing is, if the elections were then to go through the county clerk, it may be that we would have trouble recruiting board members who don't want to have to go through the filing of to run for an office that's on the ballot and do the voter's pamphlet and all that stuff.
Mr. Chair and committee members and Representative Hovey, I'm not sure when you came in, but there are members of this association that are in Eugene, permanent residents. It's a weekend home or a vacation home or a second home.
About half of our members are second homeowners, vacation homeowners, and
could not participate in the ballot or voting.
Actually, I think Representative Holby may have been contacted by one of our members already in support of the bill.
Okay.
So that concludes our presentation, unless you have more questions.
Well, looks okay for the moment. We had a request from, well, we had a request somewhere for an emergency clause in one of these documents.
That was in my... Yep. letter, and I didn't want to talk about it at this point because I kind of wanted to see, well, has this thing got legs or not? And, right. And I don't want to complicate things if we don't have to, but if it were possible, we'd like to have an emergency clause.
Mr. Chair, we'll be glad to talk to you and your committee assistant about that if you'd be acceptable to that. And,
sure. Yep, Representative Holby. One other question. I mean, I know there's other communities that have vacation-type properties, like on the coast and things like that. So are they in the same situation where people who have their second homes in those communities can't vote in those water districts or
correct
sewer districts?
I can give you an example. When I was in the county council's office, and Representative Wisnant may remember this, when Sun River wanted to incorporate as a city, then the issue was, well, who can vote in that election? And the people with vacation homes couldn't, although we found a lot of people re-registering to vote in Sun River so they could vote in that election. So it is an issue that arises throughout the state and in vacation resort communities.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Mr. Chair, committee members, my district in Sun River registered voters has gone from 1,600 to 1,200 because the population hasn't, but registered voters is their permanent home. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Well, I think we're done with you, nice gentlemen. Thank you for coming over, explaining the bill.
Thank you.
We'll work on that emergency clause, and I know we had at least one agency sort of say, "Whoa, what's this?" And so they want to read it. I'll flag it for you if they come back with any concerns.
Yeah.
And
thank you.
Thank you.
What's it? That's just what I have on the list. Is anybody else? Are you too happy to not? Not testify.
We were just here for questions.
Okay. All right. Okay, then. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3096 and open a work session on House Bill 2788 while I have a quorum. And this, you all might remember, Representative Buckley came in, talked to us about this. It has to do with the when people are donating crops, not risking their farm use assessment because they're not selling them in that case. And Ian, the Farm Bureau is neutral. Yeah, and I couldn't seem to find anybody else. Period to weigh in on this. The food bank, not here. They seem didn't come up with the idea, but they seem supportive. And that's all. I know it's not always a good idea when you can't find anybody opposed, but it seems like a good idea. That's why it's here in front of us. So that's what I know about this. And would
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 2788 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Cameron moves House Bill 2788 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Is there a point of order, reference? Mr. Chair? Yeah, does it not have a subsequent to Ways and Means?
Yes.
It does. Revenue.
Or revenue.
Yeah. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'll withdraw my motion.
Withdrawn.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 2788 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation with the subsequent referral to revenue.
Vice Chair Cameron moves House Bill 2788 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation that it be referred to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference. Is there discussion? Representative Davis.
I'll just remind the committee that when we had this hearing, thank you, Chair, the point was raised as to whether or not the expansion in Section G is actually broad enough to cover all the entities that we want. And there was some discussion about an amendment, but since no other entities have weighed in, I don't know how we would amend it at this point, but we may see it again next section if we have a church or some other sort of entity who wants to get on this game. It's hard to see the downsides. So I just make that point, but I'm in support.
Okay. Any further discussion?
Is this our fourth bill now?
Yeah, this will be number four.
All right.
Well, it's only going to the Revenue Committee.
Well,
I don't know if that counts or not.
We're moving a bill. Come on.
Three and a half.
We have five.
We have five six, already.
Seven.
This would be six.
Yeah,
two
yeah.
with recommendation.
Okay. Oh, yeah, no recommendation.
Yeah, two with two.
No recommendation. Seeing no further discussion, will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Davis?
Aye.
Representative Holdy?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Unger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cameron?
Aye.
Vice Chair Carter?
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes and the bill is sent over to the Revenue Committee. We have a high percentage of our bills moved. We only have 40 total, so we're up to like 10% of them. That's probably better than most committees. Okay, then. Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 3125. And you're just going to send, yep. Okay, Heath, come on up. Your boss is just sending you again to the wolves. And let's hear what you've got here for us.
Of course, that thing goes together.
And what's your relating clause? Is there anything we can do here since we got you? No, not really. Okay.
Chair Klim. Members of the committee, my name is Heath Curtis. I am General Counsel and the Director of Government Affairs for the Oregon Forest Industries Council. I'm here today in support of House Bill 3125. It's a rather technical fix that puts in place something we thought we already had. And if you'll entertain the diversion, I thought instead of kind of diving into the bill language, I might first describe the policy rationale for a 1995 Senate bill. That was Senate Bill 683. And you'll note in the Oregon land use statutes that it's a pretty common statute structure that you would say, here's the rule, here's, for instance, the minimum parcel size, and here's a whole bunch of exceptions to the rule. In 215.780, the rule is that the minimum parcel size for forest lands is 80 acres, and then it kind of details a number of exceptions to that rule. Senate Bill 683 created a couple of those exceptions, and one of them was what we would like to style the land exchange exception, and the other was the mom-and-pop exception. What the statute does is it says that the minimum parcel size is 80 acres. You can parcelize the land on forest land to accommodate a forest practice, provided that neither the new parcel nor the old parcel provided that you cannot create a new dwelling on either the old parcel or the new parcel, and that neither parcel can be smaller than 35 acres. That is, you can go below 80, but you can't go smaller than 35 unless one of two things is true. One, it's for a land exchange with a government agency, or two, one of the parties to the transaction owns already more than 2,000 acres of forest land. So the policy rationale behind these were our members were doing some deals, and some of them involved a government agency where you were going to sell some land to the government and the government was going to deed back to you some lands. That sometimes created the need to carve off a little piece. For instance, say you had a well or an access issue, then they wanted the ability to create smaller parcels. As relevant here, the other one was we had a number of members who were out buying forest land tracts, and frequently they would be buying them from private landowners, right? And they've got a couple hundred acres, and here you have a forest landowner with several thousand acres. And in this scenario, the mom and pop wanted to sell their property. They wanted to kind of realize some on their assets, but they didn't want to move, right? They wanted to keep their house. Well, our member companies don't ordinarily want to be landlords. They're not in the business of renting property. And for their purposes, they just wanted to buy the timberland. So the idea here was to create a carve-out that said you could go smaller than 35 acres if, in fact, one of the parties, in our circumstance, the buyer, owned more than 2,000 acres already. The idea here is that they're industrial timberland owners. They own a lot of land. The land is going to stay in forest production. There's no new homes on either parcel, and you're allowing mom and pop to realize on the value of their asset. Unfortunately, as Senate Bill 683 was finally drafted, it created a little carve-out that was, according to our notes, and we actually have pretty good notes from 1995, designed to apply to a different section of the bill. But what it said, in effect, you'll recall that minimum size is 80 acres. You can go less than 80 acres, provided there's no new parcels or no new dwellings on either parcel. And you can go less than 35 acres if, in fact, it's with a large forest landowner or for an exchange. And then sub E was inserted, which said you can't go less than 35 acres if either parcel has a dwelling on it. Well, of course, that defeats the entire purpose from our perspective. That is to say, mom and pop wanted to keep their house, right? And they don't want to keep 80 acres as sub E would require. As luck would have it, one of our members went to actually use this last year, and they encountered, wow, actually, I have a problem here. This is only like a 150-acre tract. Mom and pop don't want to keep 80. We want to buy everything but the house and maybe a couple acres for them to be on. And that was held up by sub E. So that's a long way of saying this statute effectively eliminates sub big E in 215.780 sub little d. It would allow to accommodate forest practices the creation of a parcel smaller than 35 acres if one of the parties to the transaction already owned more than 2,000 acres of forest land. If you're like me, land use statutes are a little impenetrable, and I realize you're the legislators who create the land use statutes. Please don't take that personally, but this one was a little bit technical, but I think that it's a rather simple solution for a fix that we thought we already had. And given that a new dwelling cannot be created on either parcel, I don't think it hurts anybody. So in that context, I would be happy to answer any questions on the bill.
Okay, any questions?
Well, everybody's quiet. I'm hearing crickets. So I'll say, seems pretty darn reasonable. What would be the downside, if you will?
Chair Clem, Representative Thatcher, genuinely, and I would try and think of one if I could. I'm not aware really of a downside, unless maybe there's some policy out there that smaller parcels should never be created. I think the policy rationale is that we shouldn't have a bunch of new homes on farmland, right? And this doesn't allow the creation of new homes. In fact, this just allows, you know, farmers to realize some value on their asset without taking the asset out of production, or forest landowners, as is the case here.
Let's move it.
Anybody? Okay, well, we don't have the paperwork back anyway, so maybe we'll think of some more questions in the
sweet and time. And happy to answer any questions you may have between now and then.
That's all I've got signed up, so we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3125, and I think we'll just adjourn this committee then for today.